Hello, and welcome to Animation Meditation, the weekly deep dive podcast about all things animation. My name is Andy. I will be your host for today. And with me, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia.
Hello.
How are you doing, Nadia?
I am very good. It was Thanksgiving this week, which was a little odd to do at home, but I made some vegetarian shepherd's pie, and it was delicious.
Nice. I stayed at home, made a nice big old pork roast. Ooh. Me and my roommates played some board games.
Nice. Yeah, that's pretty much... I cooked, and I lounged around. So honestly, a successful day.
Yeah, I'd say that's more successful than any other given day.
Very true.
I usually don't do more than that anyway.
That's true, but this time I cooked following a new recipe, so...
Ooh.
I know.
Ooh.
Thrilling time. Anyway... Moving on to the topic of our show.
What? I thought we were just here to talk about food.
Oh my god, I could talk about food for an hour, but alas.
All right, is a hot dog really a sandwich? That's the topic of our podcast today.
Excuse me, Andy. I am very offended as a vegetarian that you... Just kidding. That's not who I am.
Right, is a vegetarian hot dog a sandwich? We can change the substance of the hot dog. That doesn't necessarily change the question.
It could be... This is more in-depth than I expected, and I'm bringing up a whole lot of other questions in my head. Like, is a burrito a sandwich? Is a taco a sandwich?
Is a burrito a wrap?
Is a hot dog a taco?
Is a wrap a sandwich? Anyway,
something for you to chew on.
This week, we are discussing Infinity Train, Book 1.
Cue the song Crazy Train playing in your head for a week straight, because that's what I've been dealing with.
Wait, why Crazy Train?
Because that's what the song that they play during the trailer. I, like, looked up the trailer when you recommended it to me. And I was like, oh good, they did Crazy Train. And now it's just been in my head for, like, the remaining week.
I don't think I've ever seen the trailer for this show.
I mean, I'm also pretty disappointed that you didn't hear the title Crazy Train and then immediately go, I, in your head, because
Infinity Train?
Infinity Train, yes, sorry. I can't believe you didn't hear the title Infinity Train and not immediately start singing Crazy Train in your head, because that's what I did.
No, I'm so sorry that I heard the title Infinity Train and did not initially go to Crazy Train.
Well, you know.
But just because it has a train in it doesn't mean I have to immediately go to Black Sabbath.
It's called building connections, Andy. It's what we do as individuals. You gotta build those text-to-text connections, aka Infinity Train to Crazy Train.
Just give me one moment while I look up the trailer for this show.
Make sure you watch the one that plays Crazy Train in the background. I don't know if they have other ones, but that's the one that I saw.
Oh my god, I hate this.
Why?
I don't understand.
Hold on, I'm rewatching it.
But like, what is the narrative use of that song? Is it because they're on a train and the train's kind of crazy?
Yeah. I'm digging it.
This is almost as bad a use of a song as Live and Let Die was in Shrek 3.
I enjoyed it when I first saw the trailer, because I was like, yeah, this is a pretty crazy looking train. Look at them go.
But like, in terms of like the feel and the narrative, it just doesn't work.
It does not work if you've seen the show before watching the trailer. Knowing literally nothing about the show and seeing the trailer, I just assumed that it made sense.
Okay, but by definition, a trailer should give me an idea of what this show is about. And I think that having that song underscore the entire trailer for that.
Or they could just be trying to grab your interest and then crush you when you realize you were totally wrong, a la Brave.
I think...
All press is good press.
I think Brave is a completely different discussion.
Sorry, got distracted.
I mean, was there an issue with the Brave trailer?
Are you kidding me?
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen the Brave trailer?
No.
Well, see, the thing is, the trailer makes it seem like the entire film is about, like, her fighting for her own independence within a very gendered system and, like, learning to be brave on her own. And then the entire movie is that her mom is turned into a bear, which in no way or form is present in the trailer. So I was like, yay, let's go on a bout of, you know, like, feminine princess movie watching time. And then it was literally just, I don't think there's even a single bear in the trailer. And that is the entire movie.
Okay, I have not seen the trailer, so that was not my experience with going into that film. But that was absolutely my experience for the first 20 minutes of that film.
Yes.
Because that film does very much set up as, like, this is a cool narrative story that we're just going to completely throw out the window.
Yeah, so that was even more expounded by my expectations with the trailer. So the first time I saw the movie, I was infuriated because I was just like, this isn't what I wanted nor expected. And over the growing times I've seen it more and more, I like knowing what to expect. I'm like, okay, I can appreciate it. But I'll tell you, leaving that theater the first time, I was like, what did they do? So there's my aside for today. One of many to come.
So.
Infinity Train.
This was a very heavily anticipated 10-episode short series. The initial pilot had aired under, I can't remember the name of Cartoon Network's program. They have a pilot program.
Yeah, I have no idea what that even means.
Who knows? Yeah, Cartoon Network has a program where they just air shorts that are functionally like first episode pilots for things that they would consider making shows out of. This was initially one of them. Shows like Clarence, OKKO, We Bear Bear. Like, a lot of them got their start through that. And I can tell you right now, you have seen the pilot. It is pretty much a one-for-one analogy of episode 3, The Corgi Car, with, like, just a bit of context on either end to, like, actually make it flow from one episode to another, but it's pretty much exactly the same. You do see some differences in, like, the character design. Like, Tulip has some more rounded glasses. She's a bit more, not quite as, like, clean-cut in the way the animation is on her actual final design. But that had created a fan petition that initially got this aired, because they originally weren't going to do it because it was so similar to Over the Garden Wall.
Oh, interesting. Hmm.
Yeah, the pilot aired in 2016. This didn't get its syndication until 2019.
Okay. So if you want to give a brief summary of Infinity Train, and then we could dive into maybe some of those similarities, because that's interesting. I didn't know that they almost didn't do it.
It was on hold for several years because of how similar it was to Over the Garden Wall. But yeah, Infinity Train is a story about a train that actively kidnaps individuals from their lives.
Well, we'll talk about this later, but people do technically choose to go onto the train. It doesn't, like, eat them.
I think kidnap is a pretty valid word for what this train does.
It takes people. It appears to people.
When individuals are at a fairly low point in their life and they feel that they have an issue that they cannot resolve with the tools that they have on their own, this train will appear in front of them, and I'm not going to say they have the choice to go on it, because it's pretty manipulative in terms of how it gets people on the train.
Yes. But once they do board the train, they are essentially met with an infinite number of cars, each which are kind of like their own little encompassed world where they solve puzzles and challenges to move from car to car.
Yep. Each person on the train has a number that is generated based on their life. It is found on their hand. And as they go through and resolve their own personal issues and come to a point where they themselves feel that they have the tools necessary to solve the issue that they had in their real life, their number goes to 0 and they are able to go home. The show itself follows an anthology series style storytelling where each book gives its own story based on a different individual character. It is taking place in the same universe within the same time frame, so events from prior books do affect later books, but there's no overall plot structure following the same protagonist. Mm-hmm. For book one, we follow Tulip, a young 12-year-old video game coding?
Yeah, she's into computer science.
Yeah, and it opens with her really coming to terms with, like, her parents' divorce, and that's the issue that she has to, like, her role in her parents' divorce and how she's not the one at fault, and all of that is the issue that she has to comes to terms with. Can't talk today. It is the issue that she has to come to terms with over the course of the next 10 episodes. And she does so with the help of a few of the denizens on the train, a strange robot named 1-1 who's constantly looking for his mother, Corgi.
Talking Corgi.
Corgi, that is royalty, yes. What was your initial thoughts on the show as a whole?
I really enjoyed book one. I didn't quite know what to expect, and
I don't know, maybe a trailer that plays crazy yeah, you train
know,
gives you.
I like, didn't.
You do not have the greatest expectations going in.
But I essentially sat down and I mean, it's short. Again, it's like the length of a movie. But I sat down and I just kind of watched it all in one go. And I really, really loved the first season. I mean, I've talked before about how I really love character development. And that is kind of the entire point of this show. Like, it is pretty much just to develop this single character that the book focuses on. So I got a hell of a kick out of that. I am all about self-growth. So I was super psyched to see a show that is pretty overtly just like, hey, what does it mean to become a better version of yourself? What does it take to grow? How do we grapple with things that we struggle with as like the general premise? And I also love public transportation. So, you know, it matched all those things together and was like, here, Nadia, here are some stuff that you like in a show. Enjoy.
Yeah, you like trains. Take trains. There's a lot of trains.
I love self-growth. This is literally a self-growth train. So, you know, that's my jam.
The initial version of this show was actually supposed to be on a plane.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have watched it if it was a plane. Infinity plane?
Plane's a deal breaker?
Yeah. Sorry, it's all about that train life. Actually, no, like, I genuinely think I was more excited about this show because it took place on a train. I am 100% going to stand by that. Because you'd mentioned the title to me before, and I remember being like,
I know
ooh,
you.
Trains.
I genuinely believe
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that is 100% legit. I'm probably going to buy myself something
Very
from the
character.
MBTA gift shop for the holidays for myself this year. So that's where I'm at. So anyway, good thing they changed that overall general thing, because they would have lost a single viewer. Except probably not, because he told me to watch it and I kind of had to. But I would have been less happy about it had it been on a plane. So good choice, creative people.
Yeah, you don't get nearly as much ability to build out the world is on a plane as you
yeah,
do a
well,
train.
Yeah, would it have been like just like a really uncomfortably long plane? Because that would have made me deeply upset. It's just like really long. Ew, I hate it. Oh, God. Yeah, because the whole point is that, like, each car is an individual space, and, like, you move through these different spaces, each of which ask you to contemplate a different aspect of yourself or your character or your history. You can't do that on a single plane.
What if it was a train of planes?
They should do one of the individual cars that's, like, just planes. Like, you enter into it, and it looks like you're on a plane. And then there's another one where you enter into it, and they're just everything is a plane. Like, all of the little characters are just animate planes.
Like, the movie Planes?
Yes. I will be extremely angry if we don't get a season where the little sidekick is not a plane.
I don't think that fits in the aesthetic.
Shh.
Are there talking what would otherwise be inanimate objects?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me?
I mean,
we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but there's, like, a talking game spinner. There's, like, a talk...
That's season... That's book three. Come on.
You asked me. I mean, you said it wouldn't fit the aesthetic, and I'm telling you it obviously would. But you're right.
That's fair. No, that's fair. They can definitely make that work.
Exactly. And it could be like a very serious plane. It could be...
Although I do have to...
It could be like concerned about the threat of environmental pollutants. So it is struggling with, you know, who it is. There you go.
We are getting ahead of ourselves.
Yes, okay.
I do want to delve deeper into this.
Dialing it back.
When we get to it. But when I did see that episode with the game spinner, I thought to myself, wow, Infinity Train would make for a great D&D campaign.
Oh, absolutely. It's like perfect because it's just like a series of puzzles where you reveal stuff about the characters. So it would be so cool. And you could like involve characters' backstories and ideas about themselves and like bring stuff in interesting ways. Plus, I'm just like a sucker for puzzle solving. And it would be like a different...
Literal same. Yeah. But like, yeah, it would be great.
And it would be different too because it wouldn't just be about like you have to fight your way through. It's literally like you have to solve the puzzle to get through because...
And occasionally fight your way through, because it's D&D.
Occasionally, but that's not the... It's not like you fight and then there are side puzzles. It's like there are puzzles and then there are side fight, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. I think, like, if I were to make a D&D campaign, I would definitely do something along the lines of book one.
Yes. Good.
Without giving away any spoilers regarding this book, just having a antagonist that is... connected to the train yet somewhat mysterious, mm-hmm. and like having them reveal the things that happen as they go.
Heck yeah, please do that, and please invite me because I will weep with joy and that will be cool.
I need players.
Hey, you got one, and really all you need is one because there's only no, just kidding. But please make this entire D&D campaign, but make it for me and only me and nobody else. Thank you.
Okay.
What was your initial reaction of Infinity Train, Andy?
I genuinely loved it. This was a show that was recommended to me by a podcast.
Oh.
It was recommended to me by from a Riddle podcast.
Oh, heck yeah.
Called Hey Riddle Riddle. And it's got like these like improv artists, and one of them was like, yeah, I really enjoyed Infinity Train. The show's great. And I was like, oh. But an animated show that I haven't heard of, but upon initially like looking it up, it's like there's a lot of good reviews on this and a lot of like demand on this. Like I got to see like the whole like petition to get that aired as an episode and all of that. And I was like, oh, this is
people like this.
This is right up my wheelhouse. How did I miss this? Especially when it was like given the same event structure as Over the Garden Wall had been given. It was the 5-night air 2 episodes a night structure as a week long event. So I then found it, watched it, loved the entire thing, immediately jumped into book 2.
Same.
And I didn't even realize just how quickly I'd been running through it, just because like they're like you can watch both books 1 and 2 over the course of like 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
They're not very
long. It's like watching a slightly long movie. Or if you watch one, it's a slightly short movie.
But yeah, I love me some character development. I think the score
is very, it
fits the aesthetic of the show so well. It's very well done through it. It gives you this like feeling of like, and like the show itself very much has this like lighthearted Doctor Who feel, at least for book one, where you're just like, oh, this train's bigger on the inside. Oh, we're going on a fun adventure with some random people that we find. And the score very much reflects that. There is this, I remember it happening for book one, but I can't recall if it happens for books 2 and 3. But whenever Tulip starts going on like heavy rants or like any anxiety driven rants, the score sort of gives you this like heartbeat-esque pumping. And it really like drives up the intensity of the scene, which I think is great.
Heck yeah.
And yeah, the show itself is very similar to Over the Garden Wall, which is Cartoon Network's other known 5-day event, and it is one that we've referenced at least 3 or 4 times up to this point.
I would say very similar in trajectory, but not similar in terms of tone, though.
Yeah, I absolutely understand why they can feel hesitant to air it because of how similar it is on paper. But once the story was all fleshed out, once the story was all told and given, it is a very different story.
Yes. So, like, I guess they're both similar in that you sort of have these characters who are in the space of the unknown physically, but then also sort of emotionally as well, that they have to kind of unpack and figure out. And there's this overall sort of sense of mystery, and there are these episodic sort of mini adventures that each group goes through.
Yeah, it's a very similar structure. It's a series of vignettes where they're being helped by the individuals that reside in the unknown area that they find themselves in.
And then everything kind of comes to light at the end that there's sort of you learn about the, I mean, I don't know, with Over the Garden Wall, like we talked about, there isn't really a antagonist, so to speak, but at the end you learn these major things and everything kind of, all the pieces fit together. But yeah, I initially didn't even connect the two shows, silly enough, even, you know, I connected the fact that they were both miniseries and that they were both kind of these like condensed adventures and that they deal with the unknown. But other than that, it was, like you said, the tones are totally different. You have Over the Garden Wall, which is this sort of, you know, Victorian time period-esque sort of gothic tale of the unknown, and then you have this sort of modern technology Doctor Who-esque tale of the unknown. So they're both very different in that aspect.
Yeah, they're very different genres, whereas like Over the Garden Wall is like a fairy tale gothic, I almost want to say like gothic horror,
yeah,
esque tale, where Infinity Train is a much more, I don't want to say steampunky, because I don't think that's
no,
right.
No, but it's sort of like, I don't even know the right words, but like a...
Yeah, like sci-fi.
Yeah, it's like modern sort of sci-fi-esque, because you are essentially in this new world with this new technology and these sort of unbelievable feats that this train can do. So I think sci-fi fits perfectly.
But you know what doesn't say sci-fi?
What?
Crazy Train.
Ah, yes, I listened to that song and I was like, you know what this has inspired me to do? Write a science fiction miniseries. And guess what? It's gonna have a train. And guess what? That train is in fact going to be crazy. However, it will not match the tone of the song because I am not a copycat. I bet that's what the creator said. That was me speaking from the voice of the creators of the show after hearing the song Crazy Train and obviously immediately wanting to write the show.
I do apologize. I had originally attributed Crazy Train as Black Sabbath.
I was gonna say, isn't that Ozzy? It's Ozzy Osbourne, right?
It is Ozzy Osbourne. The reason I attribute it with Black Sabbath is because Ozzy Osbourne was the lead vocalist for Black Sabbath, and I thought for some reason Black Sabbath was the one to have originated it, and Ozzy just took it on later, but clearly I've got my time frame wrong. Look, in my mind, anything by Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath is just functionally the same.
I don't really know much about either, but this was my cousin's favorite song when we were kids, so whenever we drove anywhere in the car together, he would listen to Crazy Train over and over again. So that's how I know it.
Crazy Train, according to Wikipedia, Crazy Train is off of Ozzy Osbourne's first debut solo album.
Well.
So this would have been...
Nice job, Ozzy. I really like your song.
So I'm assuming this is just after leaving Black Sabbath, but that's all I got. Clearly I know nothing about music, but that's why I didn't start a music podcast.
I could pretty much only talk about show tunes and then I'd be lost, so.
What if we just did an entire episode on trailers?
Oh my god, that would be so much fun. I love trailers. I think the creation of trailers is so interesting and so cool. And sometimes I'll just sit on YouTube and just watch trailers. And then sometimes I'll watch trailers to movies that I know I can't watch because they're probably going to be too intense for me, but I get to be excited about them because of the trailer. And then I'm like, okay, I couldn't watch that film, but hey, I enjoyed the trailer.
So, Infinity Train, is this a show you would recommend? And to who? Why?
I would absolutely recommend the show. I already have, actually. I recommended it to my parents and a coworker already. I think that it's specifically talking about book one, it is a really fantastic condensed adventure that is very tightly written, that is mysterious, yet fun, and, you know, sort of lighthearted, but also deals with larger emotional issues. It has characters that you root for and who obviously grow and develop, and also all of the train cars are just really exciting and cool to see, and, you know, the show bounces back and forth from you get to see parts of Tulip's life on the train and off the train, and you get to know her as a character over the course of her own journey, and then, of course, you get the sort of, like, overarching story that comes to light at the end in a very exciting way. So I think it's a lovely show that is exciting and refreshing and well done if you like character growth, if you like medley adventures. It's bright and colorful, and the scenery background is beautiful. As Andy said, the score is lovely. So it's just, like, a really great, tight adventure that I enjoyed much more than I thought that I would, given that the trailer makes it seem a little bit more ominous and spooky than it ends up being.
What part of Crazy Train is spooky?
Well, it, like, the Infinity Train, like, Infinity Train, blah, 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 is very kind of, like, Stranger Things-esque in its logo design and little music tidbit. So I expected it to be more, like, this ominous sci-fi world where, like, the train is actively trying to harm you. Which you get aspects of, but isn't necessarily the overall tone that carries through the entire book.
There are definitely scenes in this show that definitely have that, like, Stranger Things-esque vibe
and
to
I
it.
Think I was hesitant because I thought that would be the prominent tone, which is totally fine, and, like, I really enjoyed watching Stranger Things, but I'm also an anxious individual and we're in the middle of the pandemic, so I tend to gravitate towards lighter media at the moment, so it wasn't necessarily one that I was like, do I want to watch this? How intense is it going to be? But I was really happy that I did, because I think the first book is definitely much more heartfelt than I expected, and it's got that sense of mystery and ominousness, but it also has this sense of sort of, like, safer adventure as well.
Yeah. No, I would absolutely recommend this if you're a fan of animation as a whole, if you're looking for a short structure series with fun vignettes throughout, but a solid overall story. I think if you are a fan of Over the Garden Wall anything of that kind, absolutely. Definitely recommending this to any sci-fi fans, definitely recommending this to any, I want to say Western fans. It does have a bit of, like, a Western feel to it where you're just sort of going through these different arcs.
Any public transportation fans? Here you go. If you're a plane fan, though, get out of here. This isn't a show with planes.
Yeah, there's no planes. We're not here for you. But yeah, I honestly can't think of a situation where I would not recommend this to someone. Unless you're someone who's, like, strictly against animation as a whole.
Which, what is wrong with you? Number one. Dude, why?
I don't like that concept.
That could also be an entire episode, because I've actually talked to a lot of people who are like, I don't like things that are animated, and I have a lot of stuff to say about that, so.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I am one to say, you enjoy what you enjoy, and I respect that, but also, I will die on this hill of, do not make overall generalizations over literal genres.
Yeah, and also because animation is even less of a genre and more of an umbrella, because you can have things that are animated that fall under literally any other genre.
Oh, so absolutely.
So it's just your issue with, like, a visual, well, anyway. I'm pulling myself back from going on that tangent right now.
I mean, that is absolutely a tangent we will go down in the future. Just keep posted on at AnnieMed on Twitter.
Ew. And
contact us, AnnieMed.
And then I will not hold back. Gmail. I will not hold back when we get to that episode. I'm coming for you, people with that mindset who, why are you listening to a podcast about animation?
Yeah, let's be honest, those people are not in our target demographic.
But we can preach to the crowd, and I think that has value, too. We can give you some hardcore arguments to use when people say that phrase to you, and they're like, I don't watch animated shows, and you'll be like, do I have a bullet-pointed list ready to tell you why that's a silly thing to say?
Here is my PowerPoint. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Quickly back to Infinity Train, in terms of recommending it to people after seeing all three books, I have recommended it to people with a little bit of an addendum. That is, the first book is definitely much more lighthearted, and it gets progressively darker and more heavy as the books progress, which I do think is important to say, because I did not know that. And going from season one to season three in the series of like a couple of days was a dangerous roller coaster ride of emotion that left me very angry.
No.
So I know that I don't want to give anything specifically away, but the books are very different in that they follow different people, but they are also very different in tone. So if you watch the first season and you're like, this is fantastic, I want something else that is light and lovely, maybe save the other two books for a time when you were emotionally more stable, / want something that is heavier or more intense.
Yes. Something to bear in mind is this show, I believe currently they have more than four books planned out, but originally Cartoon Network was not going to air anything past book two. It wasn't until Cartoon Network got acquired by HBO Max and Infinity Train was moved to an HBO Max original series that book three was confirmed.
Oh, okay.
Which is,
I didn't know that. That's,
and this is speculation. This is not necessarily true, but that is why I believe that the latter books in the series have a much darker tone to them.
I mean, that definitely does allow for that. But yeah, I thought that was important to say, because I was very much taken aback and taken off guard by those shifts, and I would just like to let the lovely people know that if anyone is like me,
but yeah, that's what happens when you start on a children's network with a target demographic of children and then move into a more adult demographic as the studio you're under changes its directions.
Yeah, and it does make sense. Like, I think that it is done in a seamless way. It is just, it is definitely a thing that happens, so heads up. And also on the other end of the spectrum, if you watch book one and you're like, this is maybe a little bit too light for me, and you prefer stuff that is heavier, stick around, because guess what, friend? Books two and three are gonna hand that to you on a silver platter.
Absolutely, and this is a great segue into our first topic in the spoiler section. That being said, if you have not seen the series is absolutely worth the watch. Please pause this. It is available in full on HBO Max, and watch the entire series. Come back with a understanding of what's happening, and watch it. Come back. Enjoy it with the context of the show that is very tightly animated, very tightly written, and is only about like an hour and a half to watch. That being said, I do think book one has a much heavier theme than your average Cartoon Network show, as it does open with a very serious discussion of divorce and how the children of divorce are affected by that, especially when the divorce happens at such a formative age for the child. Child in question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the show is really fantastic in that it's able, I mean, it does have this overall sort of cheeriness to it, despite sort of the sci-fi elements and the sense of danger and sort of the mystery of the train. It stays raised light while also tackling something that is very deeply emotional and very heavy, especially for viewers who might have similar family situations to Tulip and could have dealt with that in their past or are currently dealing with it as they watch. It definitely doesn't hold back in terms of talking about the impact of divorce on kids.
Yeah, when that plotline was originally being developed, the initial script had only ever said separated, and Cartoon Network came to them and said, no, just say divorced. We understand this is a heavy topic, but we do want, like, kids go through this, we do want them to
absolutely
address it and understand it. And I think that that's a very powerful message.
Yeah.
Especially, like, I cannot off the top of my mind think of a show that actively has something as heavy as divorce centered around its main narrative.
Yeah, and I was trying to think too about other animated kids shows that I had watched that even had parents in it that were divorced explicitly, because I mean, we've seen, you know, we've seen shows like Owl House where there is a single parent, but it hasn't been divulged in that show yet, like, why she is raising Luz as a single mom. So, like, I was trying to think if I have seen another show where off the top of my head I can remember the fact that either a character's parents were divorced or had been or were going through a divorce, and I couldn't think of one. And I'm sure there's something out there, but the fact that it didn't immediately come to my mind means that even if there is, it wasn't a center, it wasn't like the center of the narrative, which is why it was less important and why I forgot if I've even seen a show that is part of the characters.
Yeah, it isn't a part of the character's identity nearly as much as it is in this story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And generally when we do see parents in an animated series, they're either dead.
Yay.
or B, just not important to the story at all, or the character's identity even a little bit. So it is, and I know we haven't exactly talked about a whole lot of shows that have been doing that, because we've been focusing on more modern day shows that do actively take that role, but...
Well, a lot of historically children's literature does tend to remove and or villainize the parents, so to have a show where the parents are really central to the child's identity is...
Yeah.
Is...
And have a conflict where it's not... There's no bad guy. There's no... No one's at fault here.
Yes.
It just is.
Yes. Which is, you know, part of what Tulip has to come to terms with, because it's... I feel like, you know, especially, I mean, for adults too, but especially for kids, it's easy in a situation when you're able to determine who is the bad guy, because that makes it easier to understand. If you know who is the bad guy and you know who is the good guy, then you can figure out how the situation can progress. I don't know how to, like, phrase this. I'm, like, losing it. But, like, that makes things more clear-cut. And when you don't necessarily have that, it's hard to know what to do, because it's not necessarily something that can be fixed.
Yeah, at no point are you villainizing a character simply because they're living their life.
Yes.
Like, this divorce is something that just happens, and that's how life is, and we need to address that and
move on. Not because of the fault of one of the parents, it's not because of, you know, something that one did that was wrong that the other is now unable to... Like, it is just a joint choice that is what makes sense for them in terms of the context of their own lives as happy individuals.
We never at any point during the story learn why Tulip's parents are getting divorced.
Yeah.
It's simply something that is happening.
Yeah.
Whatever issues they had were in the past. It has nothing to do with Tulip, and we can move forward from there. And Tulip has to learn to move forward from there and accept these as facts. Yeah, Tulip's inability to truly accept her role in her parents' divorce and her inability to get them back together and her inability to solve the issues that they are having is something that really characterizes her as a person. I do really like the way they use Tulip specifically over the course of this show. I think she is a very realistically written character. She's extremely smart for a 12-year-old, but not to the point where I would not believe that a 12-year-old could come to these conclusions.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
She's extremely analytical about everything, and that is very helpful for the writers, because they're able to naturally create exposition within the course of the show that feels natural to be a conversation within the show.
Could you give an example of that? I like that.
Off the top of my head, the point where I wrote this down as a note was when Tulip was leaving the Straight Up Italy car. She takes out a notebook and she's like, all right, so these are the things that correlate to the actions that I took in the corgi car prior to this that led my number to go down. And she's like actively like speaking out loud her thoughts and her reasonings as to what is causing the number to go down and what is going to help her get off this train.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, things like that. The episode where she has to sing to a stone and she's sitting there like I was a part of the hypothesis generating decathlon or whatever the actual title of the ridiculous thing she said is like I've been trying this. It's very much like her entire mindset is the scientific process that she's just applying to everything that she sees. And it really, and like in that example in particular, she was wrong, but it really gives a means for them to explain how the train works and why the train is doing what it's doing in a way that feels natural.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have to say I love that episode because they spend an entire episode just singing all these made up like old like 90s-esque rock songs.
Yes.
And then they end it with an actual song that exists in real life. And it's the most ridiculous song they could have chosen.
I didn't actually know that it was a real song. I just assumed that it was kind of fake like the other ones. That's amazing. Now I'll have to go listen to the whole thing.
But you don't just offhand recognize Cameo's word up?
Nope. As mentioned earlier in this episode, if we did a music podcast, I could pretty much only talk about show tunes. So, that's what I'm
pretty damn close to also being able to just do that. Like, that was such a specific pull that I was like, I can't believe they did this.
That's awesome. That is a great episode.
So that song came out in like the 80s, but that was also a song from my childhood where it was like me hearing that after like at least a decade of not having heard that song before, like it really threw me back.
Hold on, I'm just listening to a little bit of it. Yeah, I definitely haven't heard that song as a kid.
But I very much empathize with Tulip a lot because, A, that was a song that my father introduced to me as a child, like, going on road trips. Like, that was absolutely, like, an experience I had.
That's
so it was,
crazy.
Like, that entire episode just me was, like, reliving things. But also, like, I'm not a child of divorce, but my parents did separate when I was fairly young. I was too young at the time to really process them being together, so I never really had the experience of trying to process them being apart. Like, that was just always a part of my identity. Mm-hmm. But, like, I understand where you come from in terms of, like, wanting your parents to be together and having to live with two parents who are trying to actively coordinate with each other and at times failing.
I was gonna say that's sort of the first moment where we see the impact of it on Tulip's life, where she, you know, she just wants to go to camp and her dad was supposed to bring her and something goes wrong with his schedule and something goes wrong with his mom's schedule and neither of them are able to do it because they...
Yeah, like that scene hit very hard for me as well because I've definitely been in that exact situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think they do a really great job. That scene hit really close to me, not in terms of her parents and the divorce because my parents are not divorced and they're together, but like I do remember that like very raw sense in middle school of just like this sheer disappointment when there's something that you've been looking forward to and it isn't able to happen and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it because you are literally 12 years old, and just this like just this sense of just unbelievable, I mean I guess it's really just despair, right? Like it's just this crushing despair and this crushing helplessness because it's a choice that has essentially been made for you and you can't do anything about it. And like you said, it doesn't even have to be that something went horribly wrong. It's just that things don't fit into place and it is enough to kind of catapult your something that you've been expecting and looking forward to into not happening. And like, I haven't felt that feeling in a very long time as an adult, but it just like brought me way back to middle school where like that is definitely a thing that I can't like remember specific instances of why, but that just like that feeling.
Yeah, and that scene in particular also has that like heartbeat-esque score to it that I had mentioned earlier. And that really like amps up the tension where like you really feel in Tulip's shoes her frustration with what is happening. And it really puts you in that mindset of this is not something that is easy for Tulip to take.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that initial scene just really sets you up to care for Tulip, because even if you don't necessarily resonate with the things that she's struggling with, whether it be divorce or coming to terms with her own, sort of her own, not, yeah, like the divorce and her, the fact that it's not her fault and that it is something that, while sad, is okay in her life, you can definitely resonate with her feelings as a middle schooler. So, like, I immediately felt connected with her despite the fact I didn't have that specific connection in terms of her life experience, but I had that emotional connection with the way that she felt in that moment, even if it was because of a different circumstance for me, and that allowed me to kind of walk onto the train with her, caring about her as an individual and character.
But yeah, what are your thoughts on the other side characters in the show? We've spent a lot of time on two.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've got, let's see, Atticus, who's the talking King Corgi, who, I mean, that's just amazing. Dude. Like, that's all I've ever wanted is for one of my dogs to be able to, like, talk and be my little buddy. And I really love Atticus because he's you know, he's like royalty and he's a corgi, so he's kind of proper and he's very excited, and but he's also still a dog. But I also love how when he introduces himself, he's like, "Hi, I'm Atticus, king of the corgis, uniter of the Welsh and the Pembroke," which is great because those are the two different types of corgis. I got very excited during that part. But I mean, I think he's fantastic. He's very sweet. He's silly, but he's also not silly to the point where he's like one of those sidekick characters that you just want to like strangle. Like, he's not obnoxious. He's just like this very lovely, kind of fun side character.
Yeah, he's more than just comic relief.
Yes, exactly. And also, if he is comic relief, it feels like a slightly different type of comic relief too. It's not like, it's just like sort of the little absurdity of him as a talking King Corgi rather than like...
Yeah, no, there's a difference between a funny character and a character that's simply there for
exactly
comic relief.
So I really enjoyed Atticus. I enjoyed 1-1 as well. I like how he has two voices. I was like a little bit thrown by that in the beginning, and then I kind of like I started to understand how, because he's, you know, this like little ball robot who can also pop into these two separate little guys, so each half of him has its own voice and its own personality, but they usually walk and talk kind of together, but also in conversation. So I thought that was really cool because I hadn't...
The fan base generally refers to them as Sad One and Glad One.
Sad One and Glad One! I love that. Because I'd never really encountered a character like that, so just kind of for sheer novelty, I was excited by 1-1. Yeah.
Yeah, the 1-1 gives me this very much like Portal-esque vibe.
Yes, as soon as he started talking, I was like, I feel like I know that voice from somewhere. And I like tried to look it up and I was like, I clearly don't know him from anything else. And like, as I watched it more, I was like, okay, so I think that I feel like I know his voice actor because he reminded me of a combination of Wheatley and John Oliver.
But it is also so Sad One is very clearly inspired by Alan Rickman's portrayal of the robot in... What's it called? What's the name of that film?
I have no idea.
Help me. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh!
It's the sad robot from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's very much like just Alan Rickman just being real sad.
Huh.
And like it's very clearly inspired by that specifically.
Okay. I did not build that connection, but I also haven't seen that film for a very, very long time.
I think they do a very good job of it. 1-1 in particular is a character that was really hit or miss for me. Like, either I loved every single thing that was coming out of 1-1's mouth, or I just couldn't stand it. But, like, there were definitely multiple times where, like, 1-1 literally made me just chuckle out loud.
Yeah.
Like, when Tulip initially leaves the train and she gets chased by I think they're called Glorbs.
Oh, or Gulbs. Okay. The, like, cockroachy dogs?
Yeah, the cockroachy dogs. She like, encounters it, and, like, it's the first genuinely terrifying experience that you get in the show. And then it's immediately followed up with 1-1 going, like, like, just singing.
Yeah.
Like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And, like, I genuinely laughed out loud when that happened. It's like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm doing a wacky getaway song.
That is pretty much your brand of humor, like, on the nose.
Like, another one that got me was, like, when they're in the turtle train, mm-hmm. and 1-1's just complaining about there being no walls, and Sad One just goes, oh my gosh, I can see their saucepans!
Yeah, I can't remember any times where he, like, overtly annoyed me, but I do remember him making...
I think there were definitely... I don't remember any offhand, but there were definitely just some, like, random comments mm-hmm. that I...
Just, like, weren't quite...
Didn't really find funny yeah. and felt were, honestly, quite invasive mm-hmm. in the narrative, but... Like, the fact that I don't remember specifically any
yeah,
of them means
like...
that, like, they weren't too invasive. They didn't, like, jar my memory.
you weren't like,
the funny
oh,
parts
God,
did.
The show is
I wasn't
dead
like,
to
oh,
me.
God.
Yeah, but I thought they were really great side characters because they are all very different, and they are all kind of following Tulip for their own reasons, which makes sense. Like, One-One is looking for his mother, and he's following along with Tulip, and then Atticus, they both get attacked by the spindly robot with the woman's face mask thing. As you can tell, I'm really great with remembering what things are called. And he, like, vows to find revenge for his people because it destroyed a bunch of their home. So he's going...
I don't believe it was revenge. It was specifically, like, we can never rest so long as this thing is alive.
Yes, so not
like,
revenge,
there's no
but,
reason
like,
it won't just come back.
Like, finding peace. But, like, he's going with Tulip in pursuit of this thing that he can find on this journey. So, like, it makes sense for them all to be together. And I like that their purpose isn't overtly there to just be like, we're Tulip's buddies. We're here to just help Tulip. Like, they have their own agendas and their own, like, aspirations in their journey with her. They just happen to be going along and helping her along the way. But it's not like, you know, the random character whose only purpose is either to be funny or to, like, they don't matter except for when they help the protagonist. I didn't feel that way about either of them. And I really appreciated that they were given their own little, like, they were given their own stories and motivations and personalities that shined away from Tulip as well.
Absolutely. And I hate that this is the second show that I've been comparing to this property, but it does feel very Wizard of Oz-esque.
Oh, yeah. One-One is looking for his mother. Atticus is looking for his peace of mind. And Tulip is looking for her
way home.
Yes. There you go. Wow. I had not built that connection in my brain.
Honestly,
but I like it.
Honestly, I would take the headcanon of the story of the Wizard of Oz was just a car on this train.
Oh my god. So I was talking to Larry about this because we had a big discussion after finishing book three, but we were talking about the different cars on the train, and he was like, well, why doesn't the train just make the perfect car for the passenger and put them on that trajectory? And I was talking about how it might not do that, but because of the individual protagonist's struggles, they will go through different cars at different paces, and the ones that are more rooted in what they're struggling with might take them longer, and then another one might be really quick, whereas another passenger might have to take a really long time in the car that the other passenger was quick in, because that the length of time corresponds with the severity in which they need to deal with whatever that car is kind of asking them to deal with. So Dorothy could essentially have been on the train and just stayed in that one car and
like
made
this.
It home
like
made it home
going
in that single car, because it just happened that she was in the one that forced her to come to terms with what she needed to most in that single space. She didn't need another car. And also, if you look at it, when she wakes up after the tornado, or the, oh my god, the twister, sorry. That's a different thing. Is it the same thing?
What's the difference between a twister and a tornado? Please.
Tornado?
Illuminate me.
Are they the same thing? Oh my god. I can't remember. I live in Massachusetts. We don't have a lot of it. Oh, they're the same thing. But anyway, when Dorothy wakes up after the twister, a whole lot of time hasn't passed. So it would make sense, because it is made clear that the time that you spend on the train corresponds with the time in the real world. So however long you were on the train, when you return back home, it will have been that many hours or days or years or whatever. Like, time passes the same. So she wasn't away from home very long. So it would make sense that she...
Do we see them sleep at any point during Dorothy's journey in Oz?
I don't think so, because she gets there... I have it on our movie list, Larry, and I want to rewatch it at some point. So if only we'd done that yesterday. But... who would have thought?
If only we'd put together this connection.
Yeah. Well, okay, so they do fall asleep in the poppy field, but...
Yeah, but that wasn't a naturally induced sleep, and who's to say they were asleep for a full 8 hours?
I do believe it is a singular journey. That it is pretty much a day. Yeah, and I mean, there is enough time while she is there. Like, you know, time does pass. There's a literal twister, and the rest of her family is, you know, in their little bunker. So the storm has to end, and they have to find her, because she's essentially tried to leave. So they have to wake up. They have to get out. Oh, no, because she tries to leave and then goes back into the house.
I'm curious if this works canonically with the book series.
I haven't read the book.
One of the biggest differences between the movie and the book is that the movie has Oz as a definitive dream, whereas the book, Oz is definitively a real place that Dorothy is able to return to.
Interesting.
And physically get to outside of sleep.
I have...
And there's this whole, like, civil war within the regions of that area. It's a very expansive lore that I would probably recommend and go further into, but this is not a book podcast. This is an animation
well,
podcast.
Well, darn, because I studied English in college and I taught it, so I would be real good at that. So
yeah, other side characters that I really enjoyed? I'm a big fan of the cat.
Oh, I totally forgot about the cat. Yeah, the cat is interesting. Why do you like the cat so much?
Her general personality is very, like, in line with the aesthetic of the show itself. She's sort of this, not quite omniscient, but very well-read individual, specifically regarding the train and who's in power and when and what happened. She's also one of the only characters that is an actively recurring character throughout all three of the books and is important to the story for all three of the individuals that we follow through the three different storylines.
Yeah, I think she also sets up the really interesting, I mean, this is, I like wasn't quite ready for this, but it's a very philosophical show. And I think she sets up this understanding that the creatures on the train have not been created, like the train itself is there for the purpose of creating the betterment of the passengers.
But the denizens themselves have their own autonomy.
Yes, they have their own history, autonomy, personalities, goals, like they are not there for the purpose of the passengers. And I would argue to different extents because there are some characters who are kind of like there as kind of like the puzzle masters of their individual cars that we don't necessarily get to know. But like the cat very much sets up this understanding that the creatures on this train very much have their own free will, their own autonomy, their own histories and personalities, and they are not there for the passengers. And I think that sets up a lot of really interesting questions about the train and its purpose and whether or not it is actually able to fulfill its goals or if it just simply puts somebody in another place where the challenges are different, but just as plentiful as the world that they've come from in terms of their own growth, like it, because they don't have these sort of like, it's not like they're given a guide who like brings them through, right? Like everyone around them is just as much an individual as
yeah, and I think that also brings up the reason why there's no specific car perfect for any given individual, because the train is not creating cars with the intent of specifically catering to one individual. It is simply a randomly generated car that is filled with means for you to grow and learn. But like, yes, we do see, like, Tulip spends about 5 months on the train. She goes through a number of cars, many of which we don't even see. And for the most part, her number remains unchanged for a good portion of her journey.
Yeah. And I mean, I understand with the way that the train works, that doesn't make sense. But, you know, I think the question is, should it exist that way? And I know that's a really big question, and we'll probably talk about that way more with book three. But that's, I don't know, that's separate.
But it's also like, can it exist that way? We don't know exactly how the train works or exactly how the train generates these cars.
Yes. That's true.
Let's be honest, if the train could work that way, would it make for a good narrative? Would it make for a good story?
Well, no, but it's about the conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
The question goes beyond the show, which is something, again, I think the show does really well, is it leaves you at the end of each season with these bigger questions that do really encourage these conversations with others. I mean, it's the same thing with Over the Garden Wall. I finished that and I literally had like a 2-hour conversation with the friend that I watched it with. And I finished Infinity Train with Larry and we had like a 2-hour conversation at the end of book three about all of these big things that ended up transcending just the narrative itself. The questions came from the narrative, but it led to these larger conversations about free will and autonomy and what it takes to grow and change and how people do that. And what it, like, all of these larger questions that were born from the narrative but then ended up transcending just the plot of the show. And I think that this show does that really, 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 really well. It literally gives you food for thought.
And the entirety of book one is really just like this exploration of what a train like this can do and what a train like this is there for. Are there any other side characters that you felt you enjoyed?
I think I just enjoyed the fact that we had a couple of set characters that she does travel with, and that we also were given all of these characters who we only got for a moment, because I think that balance was really, really nice.
Yeah.
Of, like, we got to constantly kind of see these new faces and get to know these new personalities in very brief encounters, and they were all very different. And that balanced very nicely with having these more consistent buddies that traveled with her. I guess we do want to talk about Emilia and kind of the big ending, because I think she's the only other really sort of central
prominent
side
character. Yeah.
Yeah. Quite dived into.
I think that Emilia is a good way to end this exploration of the characters. Emilia is the primary antagonist over the course of the events in this show. And I mean, major spoilers for season one, if you've gotten this far and have not seen it.
Major spoilers!
Pretty much like the entire premise of the plot twist at the end. But there is a false conductor on board the ship. It is a woman named Emilia, who had initially boarded the ship because her husband...
Train. Not ship. We have very explicitly established that it is a train.
Anything can be
a ship
if you try hard enough.
Well, anything can be a ship if you're on Nadia's shipping corner. I do not, however, ship Emilia with the
ship
train.
Ship them, I don't that care. Is, ship them, let's go.
I really think that there should have been a love interest between the fake conductor and the train.
But anyway, Emilia is a individual who initially enters the train after the death of her loved one, and upon boarding it, discovers the engine, finds the conductor, and initially asks the conductor to create a train car where she's able to live out her life with her dead husband, and that is initially disregarded by the conductor at the time. And instead of just accepting it and getting her number down and getting off the train, she usurps the conductor of their power and uses the train to make multiple attempts to recreate her former life with varying degrees of success. And a lot of turtles.
Yes.
For whatever reason, there sure are a lot of turtles involved. We do see some of the scars left over from her meddling. She's actively terrorizing the corgi car and is the monster that Atticus is trying to attack. The car that 1-1 attempts to fix, that is also filled with turtles, is very clearly a recreation of her college campus. And yeah, so Emilia is an individual who was brought on this train, and the train never really helped her at any point. Through all of the meddling and the tinkering that she did attempting to recreate her prior life, all that she managed to do was bring her number to an absurdly high amount and terrorize both the other individuals and the denizens that resided or were currently passing through the train. Emilia's story is revealed to us at the end when Tulip relives her memories and she sees all of this. And it's explicitly stated by Tulip that, great, now we have feelings for this person. Now we understand where they're coming from and how they're scared and how they're helpless. And it is her realizing Emilia's problems that also brings her own number to zero as she comes to terms with her own inability to resolve these issues on her own.
And also, I think her extended ability to empathize beyond herself, right? It mirrors her ability to understand and care for Emilia extends to her ability to attempt to understand and care for her parents. Beyond just the way that their divorce is impacting her, but also
how their divorce impacts themselves. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And I thought this was another really cool thing, because it created this little mini series where we kind of wound up not having a villain, because Emilia does do some villainous things. Like, the whole point is that her attempt to recreate her life really does mess up a lot of things for the other passengers, and she clearly has this disregard for the well-being of others, which is what drives her number up so high. But like, she isn't actively after the protagonists the way that we expected. Her goal isn't to bring destruction. Her goal is to try to regain the life that she's lost, and just the way that she does it creates this path of chaos.
She does end up killing Atticus, but she does not do so out of just simply spite. She does so because these characters were actively impeding her ability to make the car that she wants to.
Yeah, so I don't know. And I liked the fact that it wasn't like we didn't get a villain because she was redeemed, because she definitely isn't. Like, we end with her on this path to a redemption. We end with her, you know, 1-1 regains his role as conductor, and Amelia goes to kind of try to fix the messes that she's made, but we don't end with her being a redeemed character. We just end understanding her a little bit better.
Yeah, we...
And I liked that balance.
We end with Amelia being given the opportunity of redemption, but we never really address whether or not she takes
it. Yeah, and I think, I mean, one of the things that I just really love about this show, too, is that it doesn't feel the need to tie up all the loose strings for you, and it leaves parts opened in a very specific way where it's not like they were like, ah, crap, we gotta finish this season, we'll just forget about that plot line. Like, it addresses everything, but then leaves room for your interpretation and for a life for these characters beyond the world.
Oh, absolutely.
Of the show.
We do see multiple denizens throughout, and they each have their own life. The train very much feels lived in throughout, and there are plenty of stories that we may never get to see finish. Like, what's up with the Total Italy car?
And I think the literally just Italy car.
It's just straight up Italy car.
It looked beautiful and fun, and I also love vegetables, so I would have very much enjoyed that car. But yeah, and I mean, it also goes with the structure of the show. Each episode begins with, well, not each, but most of the episodes begin with Tulip leaving a car that she has just finished and solved and moving on. So we get like the end glimpse of a car, but we never actually see it. So the show is very explicit with the fact that we don't get to follow Tulip over each leg of her journey. Like, we see specific moments in that journey, but we very overtly do not see all of it.
I believe it isn't until the last few episodes that we start an episode that is a direct continuation of the prior one.
Yeah, that makes sense. That feels right. Yeah, and I distinctly remember, because when I started with the first few episodes, I was like, crap, did I miss something? Did I skip an episode? Am I watching the wrong one? Because it does pick up in that sort of like at the end of an adventure, at the start of a next moment. And I had to be like, oh, no, okay, it was an intentional choice, cool. And then I like super got on board with it and I thought it was awesome. But I was initially like, oh, crap, I missed an episode. So goes to show how conditioned you are as a viewer to kind of expect a particular structure from your shows. And I did appreciate how they kind of...
I actually really appreciated that sort of aspect of it. It does make the journey feel longer than it actually is, especially because they only have 12 episodes to work with, and if this infinitely large train only really has the 10 cars that we get to see, then it makes it feel a lot smaller. But because we see much more cars and we get this feeling that there are cars that we don't get to see at all, it makes the actual environment they're in feel much larger than it actually is.
Yeah, it also shows the gravity of what Tulip had to deal with. Like, it took her 5 months to get off the train, and it also showed, like you said, that there are a lot of cars that she passes through where her number doesn't change at all, where she's dealing with these situations that force her to think and problem solve, and that doesn't necessarily automatically help her come to terms with the divorce of her parents. Like, it takes very specific moments for that to happen. And I think that's, you know, like, we can be faced with a whole lot of challenges and grow a whole lot as individuals, but that doesn't necessarily mean that each growth is this holistic growth, right? Like, you're able to shift and improve different aspects of yourself, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are the ones that need growth or shifting, or that growth in one area means that you will automatically grow in another. Like, that is the very human way that we progress. And I thought they did a good job of showing that with Tulip in sort of the length of time where her number doesn't change, without us obviously having to follow her through all of these situations where nothing happens to her number.
Like, yeah, we are always changing, we are always affected by the environment around us, but that does not necessarily mean that these events and what is happening are specifically good or specifically what we need at that moment. And that's always going to be true, even when you are in an environment that is specifically tailored for you to grow.
Which seems like we're transitioning into some big philosophical questions.
It sure does, doesn't it?
If you wanna transition to that section, hey, this is called Big Thought.
Yeah, we are not a philosophy podcast, Nadia.
We're not a philosophy podcast, but hey, we've got some big questions to think about. Oh my god, okay. You had just said something that connected really well, and I'm forgetting what it was.
I said
what did you just say?
Something along the lines of, you can grow as a person, but not necessarily in the way that you need to, especially when you are in an environment that is specifically tailored for you to grow in that way.
Yes, okay, so the intent of the environment, I think that is an interesting thing to move into, because as we've established, the purpose of this train is to create self-growth, but all of the individuals on it are fully autonomous and make their own choices and decisions that impact the passengers in various ways. And it is not tailor-made for specific passengers. It is just a different environment, not necessarily a better environment or a worse environment. It is just different from the world that they came from. So is that difference enough to justify their removal? Like, is that enough to really say that this is something that will help someone grow?
Yeah, at what point is removing this individual from their life more harmful than it is beneficial, regardless of whether or not the intent was good?
Yeah, because, you know, I was thinking about this, I was like, hey, a train of self-growth, that sounds horrific and awesome. But, like, the more I think about it, the more, like, that the train doesn't, like, it, I mean, I guess it has sort of the overt puzzles that obviously allow you to think about yourself in different ways, but, like, you're met with just as many challenges as you would be in the real world. They're just different challenges. So is it something that is necessarily going to allow an individual to grow more than it would if they were just left to their own devices?
I don't know. Like, thinking back, like, what specific points does Tulip really addressing her parents' divorce and coming to terms with her role in their life? And is that something that you would be able to get outside of the train?
Yeah, because also, let me just go on this little rant for a second. The thing that really helps Tulip is when she sees her own tape, which is explicitly something that you are not, like, in world, are not supposed to do. You are not supposed to see your own tape. It is something that is dangerous. It is something that is supposed to get you kind of, like, caught within your own memory forever. It's not supposed to be something that is helpful or good. And that is the thing that essentially really catapults Tulip into really thinking about the fact that her betterment is coming out of her grappling with the divorce of her parents, right? Other than the fact that we see her deal with that in the real world, that is the first time that she explicitly deals with it on the train. No?
I don't know if you're offhand misremembering. I don't think that actually helped her, though. Because her really? Getting out of that tape and her initial reaction to that isn't, I'm going to come to terms with what is happening, I'm going to help myself. It is, I hate the concept of this train. I hate the concept of what is happening here. I'm not going to pay attention to my number. I no longer care if I'm able to grow from there.
Well, that's true, but that was only because at that point she didn't know what the number was.
Correct? No, she understood what the number was. The cat said, look, your number is going down. The tape helped. And she put on a glove and she said, I don't care, I'm leaving.
But she still doesn't explicitly know that the number's going down. Like, no one ever explains to her that the number going down means you get to leave.
No, she absolutely understood by that point. Because prior to those events, we had the corgi car, which brought her number down. She left the straight up Italy car literally the next episode and said, these are the things I need to do to get my number down. Prior to that, in episode 2, she asks 1-1, what happens when my number goes all the way down? And 1-1 says, you disappear forever, or something along those lines. And she takes it as she's going to die, and then the cat reevaluates that and says, what really makes you think you're going to die here?
Okay.
So, like, the tools for her to understand what that number means are definitely fed to her throughout. And I think up until that point, she understands that the number going down is a good thing. She understands that when her number reaches 0, she gets to go home.
So we have reached that segment of the podcast. Nadia says, never mind, my bad, and takes back the tangent she was about,
like,
to go
the,
on.
The tape itself, while it is a start, is not really what helps her. What helps her is her seeing others struggle in the way that she is. Like, her first real step towards progress is when she sees 1-1 struggling with the turtle, the half-made turtle car, and she has to tell 1-1, look, I understand this isn't your fault. You need to accept that and be willing to move forward with that.
Okay, that's fair, that's fair. I take back my entire rant. Never mind. abort, revert, take it away. Yeah, well, I don't remember where we were before I started to go on a misguided
rant. Is the train helpful? But yeah, like, I think they're... Because, like, with Tulip, it absolutely helped Tulip. I'm not going to say that Tulip wouldn't have been able to get the tools that she needed to be able to come to terms with her parents' divorce in the real world. But at the point when the train picked her up, she was in a situation where she very well could have just straight up died.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, I mean, it's interesting with Tulip because, as I said, the seasons get progressively darker. And with Tulip, she's able to get home in 5 months. We've already established that Amelia has been on this train for literal years, and that there are other people who have been on this train for longer. But I'm just saying, like, the amount that... I'm just trying to think about being 12 The amount that you would grow in that 5 months, which also means that she was gone for... Because she was about to go to a camp, so we're assuming it was the beginning of summer, correct?
That is correct.
No, yeah. But wasn't it snowing?
It was. Were they...
Was it winter break? Was she going to, like, a camp, like a winter break?
It was a game design camp in Oshkosh.
Okay, regardless of this...
Yes.
Regardless of the thing, she was gone for 5 months, which means that she missed a whole bunch of school. Even if it was summer, she missed a lot of school. I know that is a random thing to say.
No, but, like, it's relevant. But it does
bear the question of, like... Is the growth that Tulip does on that train, does that balance out the growth that she will then have to do after dealing with the trauma of literally being gone for 5 months and being catapulted back into the world where everybody else has gone 5 months without her? Thinking specifically about Tulip and then also about the people who are gone, which are two totally separate things.
Yeah, like there is definitely damage done when you think your daughter is out there either dead or kidnapped for 5 months.
Yeah, and there's also damage done when you return home somewhere for 5 months, and 5 months have gone on without you, and people have changed and grown, and you have missed large chunks of the world around you. That's also a huge trauma. And, like, obviously when we see Tulip, there's, like, the flash forward to 7 months, and she's going to camp, and she's happy, and she's with her parents. Like, it shows this pinpoint of a moment in her future life where things are okay. But, like, again, what the show does so well is it begs the question of, like, what are all the surrounding situations around that? And I'm just imagining just, like, this horrible reign of just unbelievable sadness where, like, her parents are freaking out and she gets back and she has, like, no conception of what's happening, and it actually has been 5 months and everything is different and, like, challenging and, like, great. She feels a lot better about the fact that her parents are divorced, but, like, now there are all of these other things that she has to struggle with as an individual who is dealing with this, like, I would definitely consider a trauma.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's heavy. And, like, even, like,
yeah,
Tulip got the good end of this. Like, Amelia...
Oh, yeah.
...was taken... It's not explicitly stated how shortly after their college graduation that Ulrich died and she was taken, but she looks pretty much identical to what she looked like after graduation. So she is mid-20s, early 30s at the oldest. And we meet her literal decades after her leaving. She is grayed haired.
Yeah.
She's aged several years, and she spent arguably a lifetime trying to recreate this. And then even from that point, if she is ever to go home, it's going to take a while longer. What's life going to be like when she reappears?
Because that'll be freaking different.
Everyone that she knew is either gone or has no concept of who she is.
Okay, so here's what I think is happening. All right, you ready? The train is actually very self-involved. Doesn't give a crap about these people. It pulls them, it manipulates them onto coming on board, makes them feel like they've accomplished something, and then catapults them back into a situation where that single person's trouble before they got on the train has now resulted in the devastating trouble or trauma of all of the people around that individual who are now dealing with the fact that they are gone, missing, / presumed dead. So it's really just trying to get more people onto the train.
So it's just creating this ultimate, like, domino effect of...
Yeah.
Do you think it's, like, feeding off of all of these individuals?
I mean, I don't actually think this
is happening, like this. But, like... I like where we're going here.
But, like, I feel like, right? Like, that could be another... It could be a devastating motivation because, and ooh, haha, it's tricky because it makes you think that you are on the train for a good reason, which then squanders the questioning of the train itself.
It's also, I'm curious to see how many individuals are not helped either prior to 1-1's departure as conductor or after 1-1 gets reinstated. Because initially all the individuals that we see who are not necessarily helped, I guess we don't actually see anything in book one, but like in book one, Tulip is helped by the train ultimately and helped by the experiences that are there. But Amelia entered the train with the correct conductor, with a train that was functioning as it should have, and still came out for the worse.
And again, we're not done with her arc, right? Like, who's to say that she is necessarily... Oh, well, actually, the numbers are to say that she's necessarily worse, so never mind. But there's a literal evidence.
There's definitive evidence that is established as evidence within the canon.
So, yeah. So she is worse than she was when she got on the train. We do not necessarily know that she is worse than she would have been if she had remained in the real world without the train's arrival, I guess is the point that I'm trying to make. We don't know that.
So I wrote down a quote from Tulip when she was, and I sort of said an iteration of this earlier, but it was as Tulip was helping 1-1 come to terms with his role in the half-made car, she tells 1-1 that there isn't a fault, there just is. And I feel like that's a concept that I have been actively consuming a lot of different storylines regarding it, which I don't know what that says about me. I don't know what that says about what I'm reading and watching and listening to, but that's absolutely something that I've really taken to heart.
So then here's the thing then, because I agree with that in the context of an individual.
Yeah.
Right? There isn't fault, there just is. But you can't apply that to the system. Oh, absolutely not. And I think what this show really does is it gets you thinking about the individual, and it also gets you thinking about the system. Because what we're talking about right now in terms of the train, like, we're really trying to grapple with is this a system and a structure that A, is doing the right thing, B, is if it has the right intention, and if it's doing what it is built to do. And if that thing is something that should happen in the first place, right? Like, those are all questions that we can ask about a whole bunch of systems that surround us as people. And I think...
Yeah, there's a big difference between what helps an individual and what helps a system as a whole.
Yeah, because again, what this train is it is really just a different... It is just a different world. And it doesn't... Like, the conductor doesn't take any active role in your own personal journey, right? Like... I mean, obviously with Tulip it's a little different because 1-1 is lost and follows her along the way, but like that is not his overt role, nor is it the role that they were designed to do or intend to do after leaving Tulip.
So I'm sure that we can talk about this story for literal hours, and I'm sure in the coming months we will, as there are
get ready.
Still two more books to go over. That being said, I believe we're going to wrap things up right about now. As I said before, this is definitely a show I would recommend if you have not seen it already for some reason. Overall, this show is genuinely amazing. I think this show has touched me in multiple different ways, specifically with the way that I relate to the main character and the struggles that they go through. We will be talking about book two at some point in the future. Next week, we will be discussing the Lego movie and the philosophical ramifications of that one.
Of toys.
We are anything. It's a philosophy podcast first, political podcast second. Everything just happens to be under the umbrella of animation. I don't know what you're talking about. That being said, we have been Animation Meditation. You can find us at AnimedPod on Twitter and Gmail. If you'd like to contact us, please feel free. We'd be happy to include any responses in next week's episode.
Heck yeah. Also, we are definitely going to talk about the other books of Infinity Train. So if you have thoughts on those that you want to... itching to tell us, please.
Absolutely.
Because that would be awesome.
The other books will absolutely be coming out sometime in the next few months, and we will absolutely be talking about book four once that gets started.
Oh, I'm nervous.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you for listening. Bye
bye.